How did Jane Austen become the literary icon and media brand we know today? The 19th century taste for the great rambling novels of Dickens, Thackeray and others left Jane Austen in relative obscurity for some decades. But with her nephew's publication of the first biography in 1870, public interest flared again, gaining a momentum that was now unstoppable. Alice Krieger reads part three of Jane's Fame by Claire Harriman.
As a single woman in possession of no fortune to speak of, Jane Austen's material estate was easily dispersed. She had drawn up a will 3 months before her death, leaving everything she owned to my dearest sister Cassandra Elizabeth. Cassandra was the person who exercised ultimate control over Jane's posterity, and who, a few years before her own death, destroyed a large quantity of her papers, leaving the life record famously scanty and unrevealing. Her motives are usually thought to have been either mean-spirited or self-protective, but the evidence points a different way. Far from thwarting the passing on of information about her sister, Cassandra kept the archive intact for 25 years and added to it assiduously, preserving every scrap of praise for her sister that she encountered. Of the few letters from Cassandra herself that have survived, one shows her still gratefully collecting scraps of praise for Jane in her 72nd year. Her interest in the book's wider fame underlines her own powerful sense of proprietorship. She had been Jane's confidant, the first reader of all the works, the person whose tastes and opinions most heavily influenced Jane's writing, and whose approval was pivotal. But there must have been a terrible loneliness to such a position when everyone who had understood it properly was dead. The actual number of Austen's books in circulation was extremely small in the years immediately following her death. But her readership grew slowly, not least through the circulating libraries, and she began to have a certain impact on literary fashions. In 1821, Byron's spurned mistress, Lady Caroline Lamb, said that though she was having trouble thinking of what to put in a new story, she had at least hit on a title: Principle and Passion. Since the fashion is to call everything in the manner of Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility. It was hardly the sort of influence that Austen could have anticipated or desired, but it shows how fashion had picked up on certain reverberations around the books. It is likely that many of her early imitators hadn't even read her novels. What they were attempting to do was not imitate her, but replicate some of her effects. The generally conservative air of her stories and strong materialist undertow. Austen had introduced a feel-good factor into the popular novel, which no one had yet thought to analyse, but which people recognised as instantly gratifying and desirable. Austen had a great many admirers among her contemporaries, whose opinions were recorded in diaries and correspondence that remained unpublished for years, delaying the spread of her renown. Robert Southey, Maria Edgeworth and Coleridge all privately expressed their high view of her work, and Disraeli, the man who once said that if he needed to read a good novel, he wrote one, claimed to have read Pride and Prejudice 17 times. Austen's popularity with her romantic contemporaries perhaps suggests that they saw more of a break with the past than had been supposed. Her attacks on the cult of sensibility, her rational but not unfeeling demolition of the cliché surrounding true love, were as revolutionary in their own way as anything in The Prelude or Don Juan. What love story had ever contained such sentiments as this, for instance, from Sense and Sensibility? After all that is bewitching in the idea of a single and constant attachment, and all that can be said of one's happiness depending entirely on any particular person, it is not meant, it is not fit, it is not possible that it should be so. Just how modern Austen wasn't remarked until much later. The adjective employed in the early 19th century was pure or natural. Not everyone shared the same idea of natural, of course, and William Wordsworth did not admire Austen. Sarah Coleridge remembered that Wordsworth used to say that though he admitted her novels were an admirable copy of life, he could not be interested in productions of that kind, unless the truth of nature were presented to him clarified, as it were, by the pervading light of imagination, it had scarce any attraction in his eyes. but as a proviso, Sara added that Wordsworth never in his life appreciated any genius in which humour is a large element. Jane Austen's novels were not essential reading for the high Victorians, and certainly were not beloved. Her readership looked insignificant compared to that of Dickens, Collins, and Thackeray, all selling in their hundreds of thousands to the new mass market. In the 52 years between her death and the publication of the first biography in 1870, Jane Austen was hardly mentioned in the public sphere. Though Queen Victoria recalled reading Northanger Abbey with pleasure to Dear Albert, the deluxe dedication copy of Emma that had been presented to her great-uncle the Prince Regent in 1815 was relegated to the servants' library, where it seems to have remained unread for decades. It probably owes its present state of good preservation to the neglect it found below stairs. Letters and biographies of Austen's near contemporaries were beginning to emerge that affected public perceptions of figures from the previous generation. The most influential was Elizabeth Gaskell's best-selling Life of Charlotte Bronte in 1857. Not only did she present Bronte as the preeminent female novelist of her age, but Gaskell's pacey and highly coloured prose had thrilled readers and quickly established a potent cult following. The Brontes' shocking novels easily eclipsed Austen's steady but by no means universal renown. Worse for Austen's reputation, Gaskell's biography quoted letters from Bronte in which she made clear her dislike for Austen. "Can there be a great artist without poetry?" This rhetorical question had an undeniable resonance. Austen was certainly without poetry. She eschewed extravagant language and dramatic situations, and any but the sparest descriptive passages. In Bronte's view, and that of many readers since, this disqualified her from a certain seriousness of attention. She was in a different, much tamer league, one concerned with realism, restraint, and understatement, all of which the younger novelist wished to challenge. The flights and transports associated with Romanticism are all treated with deep suspicion in Austen's novels. In Persuasion, Anne Elliot recommends a larger allowance of prose in his daily study to Captain Benwick, like a literary high-fibre diet, and later in the book reflects that it was the misfortune of poetry to be seldom safely enjoyed by those who enjoyed it completely. The strong feelings which alone could estimate it truly were the very feelings which ought to taste it but sparingly. It is easy to guess how much Austen would have disapproved of the abandoned sensuality of the Bronte sisters' novels. But in 1857, it was Charlotte's view of Austen that was being brought to readers' notice. "She maybe is sensible, real, more real than true," Bronte concluded witheringly, "but she cannot be great." Jane Austen is now considered to be one of the most difficult of biographical subjects, second only to Shakespeare in terms of how little of the life is knowable and of what interest it is. The complexity of the novels, the originality, intelligence, and vitality of the mind behind them make many of Austen's admirers long for more evidence of her inner life. But when James Edward Austen Lee wrote the first biography, his agenda was very different. It was to point out the wholesomeness and harmlessness of both his subject's life and works. He calls her "Dear Aunt Jane" in the very first sentence of his book, and encourages the reader to adopt a similarly familiar viewpoint. "We did not think of her as being clever, still less as being famous, but we valued her as one always kind, sympathizing, and amusing." Though he states that there was scarcely a charm in her most delightful characters that was not a true reflection of her own sweet temper and loving heart, he doesn't provide any examples of how exactly she might have resembled Emma Woodhouse or Lizzie Bennet, nor does he stray into the territory of whose imagination created the less delightful characters in the books. Just where Austen could be placed in terms of class was a major preoccupation of his book. The early 19th century seemed coarse and bumptious to the affluent gentlefolk of mid-Victorian England. The Chawton ladies with their donkey cart and chickens, their pokey parlours and homemade caps, were something for the nieces and nephews to look back on with a certain fond embarrassment rather than pride. and James Edward included in his book many passages on changing manners, clearly intended to head off any misjudgment of the family as vulgar or poor. The fact that the Austens grew their own potatoes, for example, and furnished their home in a way which would appear to us lamentably scanty. He apologised too for the few extracts from his aunt's letters. The reader must be warned not to expect too much from them. He certainly could not be accused of overselling his product. James Edward's book was undertaken for defensive reasons. It sought to answer vexatious questions about Austen and nip any further questions in the bud. One of the central unspoken questions was that of the propriety of a decent woman being a professional writer at all, a question Southey had answered roundly in 1836 in a letter to Charlotte Bronte. Literature cannot be the business of a woman's life, and it ought not to be. By emphasising his aunt's imperturbability, the seamless segues from creativity to domesticity, James Edward showed that it was really no bother at all having an artistic temperament. Nice, even. Everyone agreed that the biography ought to contain an image of the subject, but there were only two sketches by Cassandra, and neither was considered of any value. A Mr. Andrews was commissioned to bring one of these up to an acceptable level of pulchritude, and the result was a pastel-coloured image of a chubby, vacant-looking young woman with huge eyes and pink cheeks. Her clothes were tidied up, with a frill appearing round the cap to frame the face. Her slumped posture was rectified, the folded arms unfolded, and the right eye brought down level with the left and rotated to a less cubist angle. Even the chair that this new Jane Austen was sitting on got a makeover to something more polished and substantial with a decorative curve. One niece remarked of the portrait, "It is a very pleasing, sweet face, though I confess to not thinking it much like the original." It is the engraving of Andrew's painting by the firm of Lazars, which has been endlessly reprinted, copied, parodied, improved, and which was the first authorised image of Austen offered to the public gaze. The only thing all three portraits have in common is the same number, position, and direction of curls of brown hair emerging from the subject's headgear. In terms of what Austen actually looked like, they're just about all we can cling on to. The picture, however, certainly worked like a charm on the reviewer in The Spectator. It is a great comfort to us to have so complete a verification of the theory we have always cherished, that Miss Austen's personal character was a sort of medium between the heroine of Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth Bennet, and the heroine of Persuasion, Anne Elliot. The portrait entirely bears out this double likeness. It is refinement, playfulness, alertness, rather than depth of intellect, which the face seems to express. Mr. Andrews and Messrs. Lazars had done their job well. Now a singular change took place in the public's attention to Austen. The memoir attracted dozens of reviews and quickly sold out its first edition of 1,000 copies, and its subject seemed to fire readers' imaginations to an extraordinary extent. It was almost universally welcomed as a comforting verification of what readers had hoped, that Jane Austen's humour and irony, unlike that of later Victorian novelists, arose from a contented mind and a life of perfect calm. But thoughtful readers questioned the likeliness of the portrait set against the works. The novelist Margaret Oliphant complained that James Edward had completely overlooked the fine vein of feminine cynicism which pervades his aunt's mind. He had opened the floodgates to speculation and curiosity about his aunt. She was public property and on her way to becoming a national treasure.
And tomorrow, by the early years of the 20th century, the divine Jane Austen cult had seized Britain and America. Alice Krieger read Jane's Fame by Claire Harmon. It was abridged by Polly Coles and produced by Clive Brill for Pacificus Productions.
Join me, Mel Gedroych, each weekday afternoon on the 4 o'clock show as we hear more of the entertaining entries that have made the shortlist for Radio 2's 500 Words competition for writers aged 13 and under. And if they're anything like those that have been part of the fantastic 50 so far, we can anticipate more terrific tales by awesome young authors.
The teachers had explained what to do about bullies during our induction days, but it wasn't a lot of use when the school bully turned out to be the art teacher.
In the silence of the morning, there was no way he could have known what was going to happen to him that day.
I had brought out amazement from the depths of your soul.
500 Words continues on the 4 o'clock show weekday afternoons on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, this is Susan Ray with storm-tossed, roistering, seafaring adventure this hour. Who else can it be but Patrick O'Brien? It's the final episode of The Mauritius Command, the fourth novel in O'Brien's Nelsonic epic series. Tap out the weevils from that ship's biscuit and relish that single tot of rum. You will need it. And later, in Off the Page, Chris Bigsby referees a debate about taboo. Is anything still forbidden these days? At 6:30. To resume, Captain Jack Aubrey has been promoted to Commodore to lead a squadron of English ships charged with taking the Indian Ocean islands of Mauritius and Réunion from the French. He needs subtlety and subterfuge to win over the crews and subordinate captains of his own fleet, including the courageous but brutal Captain Corbett.
Sir, your petition has never before experienced such oppressive usage as we have laboured under the whole length of this our time on the East Indies station. Captain Corbett's capricious temper, on the least occasion, will cause us to be beaten with large sticks, which he has given directions to be specially made. Some men about the Nereid have been beaten 3 or 4 times a day, so that they've been incapable of doing their duty. At times, men are punished with the thieves' cat, and when the skin is broken, Captain Corbett has had salt pickle put upon their backs. Sir, we are the men of the Nereid. January the 8th, 1809, off Madagascar.
Marines, load your muskets!
Mr. Noble.
Sir?
Who is the leading man here?
Wilkinson speaks for them, sir.
What is the man that dares to say to me that he will not weigh anchor?
All of us for Calcutta!
Are you the leading man then, Wilkinson?
The company will only weigh for Calcutta, sir.
The main top's cabal does not order this ship, I do! Up anchor! Mr. Noble, put that man in irons.
Aye, aye, sir. Wilkinson? You must come below with me.
Marines, point your weapons. You see the power set against you. Humanity induces me to separate the misled from the guilty.
Wilkinson, you are ordered below.
Which I call you to witness, sir. There is no violence.
I warn you to hold your tongue. This is a very awful time. It shall not go well with you.
No, sir. But we have written to the Admiral at Calcutta. We will have redress.
I will read each man's name from the open list. You will join the officer of your watch or stay where you are and be considered a mutineer. Ackroyd, Ainley.
Sure liberty is everywhere denied. Sentries are posted about the ship to stop men from running. We're more like a prison ship than a man of war. From gunfire in the morning until sunset, the gangway is attended by a master at arms to prevent more than 2 men at a time going to the privy. So some discommode their trousers.
Admiral Bertie of the Cape says he keeps an excellent discipline.
That perhaps tells you rather more about the Admiral than about Captain Corbett.
He was made post by Nelson himself, Stephen. Stepped straight from the Bittern into Amphitrite. Lord, what I should give to have had such a step. From such a man. I met Nelson the once, did I tell you ever?
Not above 100 times he asked you to pass the salt.
You will never understand. I believe you do it deliberately.
Captain Corbett, then.
A most zealous officer, has a considerable acquaintance with the waters off Reunion and Mauritius, a tendency to...